Parshat Re'eh, and this is a line that has, the title of this is a line that's, I'll be honest with you, it's always bothered me. The Parshat Re'eh is broken up into several sections. The first section, which occupies a good part of Perek Yud Bet, is about the centrality of worship. Matter of fact, that became and continues to be a big topic in the whole higher biblical criticism, documentary hypothesis issue, because the fact is that when you read Vayikra, and we looked at this in a different angle this year, when you looked in Vayikra, the focus is in the Machaneh, about having to bring the Korbanot to the Mishkan, but there seems to be no prohibition about setting up alternate Korbanot, or alternate worship sites. And Sefer Dvarim, there's a huge emphasis, which is this focus here, on only bringing everything to one worship site, the place that Hashem chooses, which of course is not named here, because it becomes Shiloh and then later becomes Yerushalayim permanently. Just as a footnote, in a critical piece, one of the few explicit mentions of Torat Moshe it doesn't say Torat Moshe, the few explicit mentions of Sefer Torah in Nevi'im is in Malachim Bet Perek Chaf Bet, when in the times of Chizkiyahu, Shafan HaSofer finds a Sefer Torah, Chizkiyahu Kohen, find a Sefer Torah in the Beit HaMikdash, and they bring it to Chizkiyahu, and they read it, and he rends his clothes, Yoshiyahu, he rends his clothes, and he's upset, and then there seems to be a reform to obliterate the Bamot, the other worship sites, and so the claim is that the book that he found was Sefer Dvarim, that focuses on the centrality of worship in this passage, and then the DH guys want to say that Yoshiyahu co-authored Sefer Dvarim, and it goes on from there to all sorts of other very creative flights of fancy. But in any case, let's take a look at this, because there's one line, you could say I bolded it, I made it red, and then I bolded the red with a slightly darker shade of red to show the passage that at least bothers me. The introductory piece to this is, and then there's the foreshadowing to the ceremony on Grizim and Eval, and then you're going to come to the land and keep the mitzvot. And then so this is an introduction to the whole Neuma mitzvot. Alright, and here we go. You have to destroy all the places that they worship. And this alludes to the high places and to the Asherot, etc. Essentially, break apart and destroy all the Avodah Zarah. Wipe out their name, meaning the name of Avodah Zarah, which means that hill should no longer be called Baalat, but instead called Kiryat Yarim, for instance. And then Lo Tasum Kein L'Adonai L'Echem. Important footnote is that pasuk is the source of the prohibition of, for instance, erasing God's name, or of destroying anything of Kodesh. If you take a stone out of the Mizbeach, you violated the Slav. That's Gemara in Makot. All right, because you're supposed to destroy their mizbachot. If you take one stone out of the mizbeach in Yerushalayim, you've done what you're supposed to do to them. You've done to Hashem. Okay, now, kim hamamakom. So notice that the emphasis here is, don't do what they do. Rather, kim hamamakom eshivchar Adonai lechem mikol shivtechem lasum et shmo sham. There will be one place that God selects from all of your tribes to put His name, as opposed to ibadatem et shmam l'shichnot tidrushu v'atashama. So go seek out the place where he lives and come there. That's where you're going to bring your olot. So the idea is not on the top of all these mountains and under these trees, but rather the one place that God chooses to put his name. And as Avi and I were talking about in the kayak this week, part of the problem is also the mention of Trumat Yedchem, right, which Trumot you don't have to bring to the Mikdash, so that's why Chazal interpret Trumat Yedchem here means Bikurim. In other words, they interpret every one of these lines as being specific to things that have to be brought to the Mikdash, and the idea is that it's only one place you bring it to. Okay, by the way, up until now it's all clear, it's all clean. Until Pasuk Zayin, everything is really very easy to understand. That there is a behavior of the pagans that you're going to encounter in the land, which is to identify all sorts of mountaintops and under trees, etc., as being holy places, and they offer up their offerings there, etc. Right? You don't do that. Rather, there's one place God chooses, that's where you bring everything. Okay. And it's not the first time in the Torah that we've seen this is what they do, and you do the opposite. However, this is what's strange. Lo ta'asun k'chol asher anachnu osim po hayom. Which means? What does that mean?
Don't do all that
that we've been doing today, which sounds like today is not good. Very strange. And then what is that? Ish kol hayashar b'enav. Which means what? Everybody does whatever they want. Which makes it sound as if somehow in the Midbar, Moshe is talking to the generation that was born in the Midbar, the second generation, and saying, you guys are all just doing whatever you want. When you come to the land, you're not going to do that anymore. Because you haven't yet come to the inheritance. It sounds like today things are hefker because we're not yet there. That's what it sounds like. But you're going to cross the Yarden. And then so in other words, right now you haven't come there yet. You're going to cross, and then God's going to give you respite. Means you'll fight for the land. You get the land. You'll have peace. And then the place that God chooses, that's where you're going to take all of your korbanot. Okay, and now a repetition. Do not bring your korbanot anywhere that you see. The one place Hashem chooses, that's where you bring the korbanot, which, by the way, we've now gone into redundancy. And this is the beginning of allowing us to eat meat that's not a korban if we're far away, and that's what the next parsha introduces. Skip. And then, in other words, in that parsha that's elided there, there is allowance for profane meat, I guess you'd call it, non-sacrificial meat, that can be brought, it can be eaten wherever you are, but if you have kodashim, you have to bring them to this place again. Now you wonder why I'm bringing all of this because of this last pasuk. Shmor v'shamata et kol advei ma'ilat shmor chibin tzaveka l'man yitav l'cha uvanecha acharechad olam. So do all of this and then it'll be good for you. Why? Ki ta'aseh hatov v'yashar v'einei adonai Elohecha. You'll do that which is right and good in the eyes of Hashem. And so I color-coded this blue as opposed to the other one, which is ish kol yashar b'einav, and on the other hand it is hayashar b'einei Hashem. So it's Be'enai or Be'enai Hashem. And that seems to be the two opposites. But the real crushing question here is, what does Moshe Rabbeinu mean that everybody today is doing each kol yashar Be'enav? What is going on in the desert that's so terrible that Moshe is saying, from now on, you're not going to do this anymore. Rather, and it sounds as if, just based on the negative consequent that what they've been doing is offering korbanot all over the place in the desert, which is not true. They've got a mishkan, and anybody who brings a korban brings it to the mishkan. So everybody's scratching their head on this, which is why there's a whole page of makorot here, and this is just a tiny selection. So the mainstream approach in Midrash is taken here in the Sifri, but we see it all over the Gemara. Ish kol yashar b'einav in source 2. So the way they understand it is, ish kol yashar b'einav doesn't mean something nefarious, like everybody's doing whatever they want. But rather it means that which you want to do on your own. So a korban that you want to bring on your own, that you could bring wherever you want. Where's that? That's bibama. When are you allowed to have a bama? When there is no Beit HaMikdash. So when you come into the land, you have the Mishkan set up in Gilgal. Then you set it up in Shiloh. That's the only place you can go. But when Shiloh is destroyed, you can set up bamot. And you can bring, in a personal bama, I mean like in your backyard bama, you could bring korbanot, which kind? Ish kol ha'ashar b'enav. Which is, I want to bring an olah. My wife just had a baby, I want to bring a shlamim. You know, voluntary. But a chatat, you can't bring there. Which means, by the way, we've turned the phrase ish kol ha'ashar b'enav inside out. Instead of it being an accusation of terrible things that you're doing whatever you want, you're not following God. Instead, it refers to a particular class of korbanot that are brought when you just want to bring them instead of an obligation. Here we go. V'chol she'in nidav v'nidav in korban yachid. Rabbi Shimon famously disagrees. This is, by the way, in the Ein Beins in Megillah. Rabbi Shimon omer hayom anu makrivim chatot v'ashamot mishnevo la'aretz ein anu makrivim chatot v'ashamot. So look what he says. We're bringing chatot and hashamot, Moshe says, today in the desert. But we're not going to bring chataot and hashamot later on, therefore it's going to be ish kol ha'ashar b'enav, which means both of them are interpreting the phrase ish kol ha'ashar b'enav as not being about bad behavior, but what kind of korban? A korban that's yashar b'enav, meaning I want to bring it, and that's legit, and that's nice, or one that I'm obligated to bring, which you must admit is very far from a simple read of the text, which is why you have an interesting twist in the Midrash in Midrash Agadah. It's a later Midrash in Dvarim. So Amar Moshe, source 3. Shatem nechasim la'aretz lo yasur alechem habamot milakriv alehem k'shem shasuro tayom. It's a wild turnaround because it sounds from the text as if today we're hefker, but in the future things will be fine. Now we're saying the opposite. Today we're fine, but in the future, things are going to be, you're going to be allowed to have bamot. In other words, the way they're reading it is, lo tasun kechol ha'ashar anachno sim po hayom, rather ish kol ha'ashar meinav. In other words, not, don't do what we're doing today, which is everybody does whatever they want, that's terrible, but rather, you don't have to do what we're doing today, rather in the future, you'll be able to do whatever you want. Which is, again, turning it inside out, but in a different way. And it's saying that, unlike today when there's only the Mishkan, here, lo yasrael chem b'mot l'akriv alehem k'shem shasurot tayom. This Midrash is actually quite wild in its creative approach to the text. It's saying, lo tasun kechol ha'ashar anachno sim po hayom. Rather, ish kol ha'ashar b'enav. K'mo she'ne'emar, right, and then they quote the pasuk from Vayikra that you could only bring it to the Mishkan. Achar she'tichantzu la'aretz tuchul ha'asot ish ha'ashar b'enav. Once you come to the land, you can do whatever you want. Bring a korban in your backyard, whatever you want to do. Because once you mutarot lachem abamot, and then that caveat that we have to throw in is, well, as long as you're allowed to do bamot, which is, you know, when there's no mikdash. Okay. Now, again, the simple read of the psukim is that this phrase has nothing to do with korbanot, but has something to do with wild, untutored behavior, uncontrolled behavior, incorrigible actions, or something of that sort. And not about what particular kind of korbanot, or even where you bring them. That's what it sounds like. And what we have is essentially a literary problem. The phrase alone seems to be speaking about nefarious behavior. The phrase in situ, in its context, seems to be talking about korbanot. And korbanot, which somehow have to do with the singularity of the location. So either, to read it like the first Midrash, today you're bringing it in all sorts of places, in the future only one place, or the opposite Midrash, today you're bringing it in only one place, but when you cross the river, you can bring it in a lot of places, sometimes. A little bit strange, a little difficult. The psikta is an 7th century Midrash, has a whole different take. And if you take a look at just the bottom of the Midrash, three lines from the bottom, Amar Ish Kol Yashar B'Enav, Kuma Lo Tiyu Ish Kol Yashar B'Enav Yaseh Be'ech Tavo Ba'aretz, Ela Asu HaTorah V'Mitzvot. So it pulls it out of the context and says, Ish Kol Yashar Be'Einav is really about wanton behavior, untutored behavior, uncontrolled behavior. Don't do what we've been doing till now, which of course is very strange. What, in the midbar, we've been acting badly and doing all these terrible things? So the Midrash says, not possible that we could speak about that generation standing in front of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's not possible. So now we have another twist, which is the Midrash is saying, which is Ish Kol Yashar Be'Einav. Of course, it can't mean really Hayom. So what does it mean? It's referring to another period, which is the period of the Shoftim. Which is very odd, because when Moshe said Hayom, he meant Hayom. So to say, okay, prophetically, we can look back and say, well, Moshe was accurately describing the period of the Shoftim. Why would he pick the period of the Shoftim? Why would they pick the period of the Shoftim in this Midrash? So was he going to see it? So Rashi takes the position of the first Midrash, which is Heter Bamot, the standard Talmudic approach, which is that what Moshe is saying is, up until now, you have been offering, you have the permission to offer in all sorts of places. When you come to the land and Hashem chooses a place, that's the only place. Okay, good. The Rashbam, if you turn the page, is going to see, going to show something a little bit different. And this is in sort of in the spirit of the second Midrash. In other words, he points out, and even as it goes in a similar direction, we've been traveling. So where have we been offering korbanot? We offered korbanot in Chashmona. We offered korbanot in Yotvata. We offered korbanot in Almon Divlataima. In other words, wherever we camped, we offered korbanot, which means, where is the place? GPS it. But when you, so what's Ish Kol Yashar Be'Einav? Ish Kol Yashar Be'Einav means, till now you've been offering korbanot anywhere. But when you come to the land, there'll be one place Hashem chooses and it's not going to move. Well, except once, but okay. Except twice. Well, okay. I mean, Gilgal, Shiloh, and then Yerushalayim. But okay, there will be an eventual place. But you understand what's difficult about this? What does Ish Kol Yashar Be'Einav sound like? What? It sounds something criminal. And it also sounds very much up to the individual, which is why the Midrash took it as being about Korbanot Nedava, something I want to bring. But to say that Hashem chose to make the cloud go up and move 5 miles that way and settle down, and now you're in, how do you call it? You're now in Iyim or wherever you are next, and that's what he set up. That's Ish Kol Yashar Be'Einav. No, that's B'nai Hashem. Hashem decided that's the place for this week or for tonight or for the next 38 years. And that's where you bring Korban out. It's a little bit difficult. So we have essentially three different approaches in parsing this phrase. And every one of them comes out with a little bit of a lack of satisfaction. The first one, which is the major midrashic take, which is taken in the Gemara halachically, is Ish Kol Yashar Be'Einav means that you cannot bring korbanot wherever you want to. It's the isur bamot. The only other problem is, why would we think B'nai Yisrael were doing that in the midbar? The other is the opposite take, which is to say, lo tasun kechol asher anachnu osim po hayom. We're not going to do anymore this single place thing that moves, but rather, ish kol asher be'Einav, in the future you can do whatever you want, build a mizbeach in your backyard, that's all fine, when we're allowed to. And then we have the third approach, which is to say, that this is talking about bad behavior, but the bad behavior is, which means it's totally out of context of korbanot, but the bad behavior is not about now, it's about the shoftim period. Very difficult. Yeah.
Is it possible that, and this also might be a little bit stretched, but Ish Kol Yashar Be'Einav there is talking in Hashem's eyes, whenever the cloud would move, whatever every man doing was right in God's eyes, meaning it moved here, so that must be what was right in God's eyes, or here, that must be what's right in God's eyes.
Great idea. Look at the front page again, and look at the red versus the blue. How does the Torah say what it wants to say in Hashem's eyes?
B'nei Hashem.
Right? Ish Kol Yashar Be'Einav clearly means what's right in that guy's eyes, And the idea is my eyes are different than your eyes, so you do it one way, I do it a different way. Right? Because we do have a phrase for that. Right? It's a good attempt to try to bring it together. I just want to show you, the Ramban quotes the Ibn Ezra and doesn't like it, and he gives the following explanation, which again is still working within this more or less the same general framework of Al Pirush HaKatuv. It's in the bigger print in the Ramban in source 8. Ki Yisrael nitzavu b'midbar lizboach kol b'karam etzonam mushlamim lifnei mishkan. What were B'nai Yisrael told? If you want to bring a korban, you got to bring it to the mishkan. You want to have meat. Right? Aval be'ezom akom shiyah mishkan yaseh otam. It'll be wherever they are traveling. Lo yitzel l'chol shor v'aseh lo yitcheyev lavi korban kol. But there were no obligations to bring korbanot at all. The Ramban says that here's what's changed. In the midbar, there was no obligation to bring korbanot. All there was if you want to eat meat, bring it to the Mishkan. But that's very different. And this is like the Rashbam said, which is, it's a traveling spot. You don't want to bring a korban, don't bring a korban, as long as you want to be vegetarian, bakasha. Right? There were nothing you're obligated because those things are all obligated only when you enter into the land. So now, how does the Ramban interpret Ish Kol Yashar Beinav? It means you do it if you want to. You don't do it if you don't want to. What's going to happen when you come to the land? And this, by the way, explains those other things. Is you're going to have to bring Maser and Bechor and Truma and all of those things. Those are going to become obligations. And you know what you're going to do? You're going to bring all those obligations to the one single place that Hashem chose. So what the Ramban gains with this interpretation is that Ish Kol Yashar Beinav fits the model. It's accurate to history. But now what's difficult about it is we're softening the meaning of Ish Kol Yashar Beinav. It doesn't mean bad behavior. It just means voluntary behavior, which means until now is voluntary. You want to have fancy lunch? Fine. Bring an animal to the Beit. You don't want? Don't bring. No obligations. There's no olat riyah. There's no korban todah. Nothing. Suddenly, you're going to come to the land. Then you're going to have all these things you have to bring, and you're going to have obligations. It's very nice, but again, it seems to soften the blow of Ish Kol Yashar Beinav. The Bechor Shor goes in a very similar direction as the Ramban. So, confession. I'll tell you why this phrase has always bothered me. Right? I'm just an example. Avi and I were kayaking on Monday. And he saw that while it was working, my mind was elsewhere. He says, "What's wrong?" He said, "He's quite shut me up. I don't get it." Right? We obsess about different things. Right? Ish Kol Yashar Beinav, I don't get it. Because I grew up with Ish Kol Yashar Beinav as being a real statement of criminality. And here it seems to be so soft-pedaled about particular kind of korbanot or about the heter bamot afterwards. It's kind of strange how it gets soft-sold. So I went back to the source. And the source is Ish Kol Yashar Beinav, where it appears most powerfully. Remember what the Midrash says? The Midrash says, Ish Kol Yashar Beinav, the Psikta, refers to real criminality, but it's not in the day of Moshe Rabbeinu, because no way is Moshe Rabbeinu sitting there saying, you guys are all a bunch of criminals. It's referring rather to the period of the Shoftim. Well, it's a big stretch to say that Moshe Rabbeinu was saying Hayom and referring to the Shoftim. Right? Parshat HaZinu, I totally buy this. Shirat HaZinu is exactly about the period of the Shoftim. You look at it line by line, it's totally about the Shoftim, that period. And that's the way some of the Tanaim interpret it. But to say that Hayom refers, that's difficult. But I want to start with the Shoftim. Where does that phrase show up? Ish Hayashar Beinav. It shows up twice at the end of Sefer Shoftim. Now, one quick comment about Sefer Shoftim. Sefer Shoftim is made up of three sections, very clearly discernible. There's an introduction, which is 2.5 chapters. There is what we call Alilot HaShoftim, the stories of the Shoftim, which take up approximately 14.5 chapters, 13.5 chapters, going from Otniel all the way down to Shimshon, and down is really the way to describe it. And after Shimshon, we have two stories. The last five chapters are made up of two stories. Two stories which are the story of Pesel Micha and the story of Pilegesh Begivah. Two terrible stories in which everybody's competing with who can be worse than the next guy. And those two stories, by the way, did not happen at the end of the period. They happened near the beginning of the period. In Pilegesh Begivah, the one name that shows up of anybody who's there is Pinchas. And so Pinchas is already an older man at the time of Yehoshua. So he's the beginning of the period. The one name that's significant that shows up in the Pesel Micha story is Moshe's grandson, Yonatan ben Gershom. So these happen early. Why are they at the end? They're at the end because Sefer Shoftim is presented as an argument why we need a king. And so at the end of Sefer Shoftim, after all the stories of the individual Shoftim, the text presents two stories which are presented as sort of typical stories of the wantonness, lawlessness of the period. And just read them, they're just awful stories. I read them like on Tisha B'Av or something, they're awful stories. So the first story starts off, the first story starts off with a note after being introduced to the characters, Micha and his mom. Bayamim ahim ein melech b'Yisrael, isha yashar ben av yaseh. There's no king. Everybody's doing what they want. And that introduces a story of absolute just hefkerut that's terrible. In the middle of that story, we get another line, Bayamim ahim ein melech b'Yisrael. We don't get the rest of isha yashar ben av yaseh, but we get a long story with isha yashar ben av yaseh, where Shevet Dan did not capture their own territory. And so Shevet Dan sends a mission of five guys to go scout out some territory in the north. They stop at where this Micha guy is. They get direction from him and find out, you know, that there's a place up there. They go up there. They come back. They report there's a cool place. 600 men of Dan come up. And they then confiscate Micha and his gift shop and his little idol shop and his Kohen, and they take him up north, and they kill everybody up there. It's just a terrible story, all left to right and center. The Avodah Zarah involved, and the rats, just all bad. Then we get the goriest story in Tanakh, right, which is Pilegesh Begivah, which is introduced to Yisrael. And then we hear a terrible story, again, about people outdoing each other in wickedness. You can't top it. And how does the entire book of Shoftim end? Bayamim ahim ein melech b'Yisrael, ish hayashar be'inav yaseh. Every man does what's right in his own eyes. But what you notice, the two things that are connected here are ein melech b'Yisrael and ish hayashar be'inav yaseh. Somehow, those two, and we understand why, if there's no law and order, there's anarchy, everybody's doing whatever they want, and it can lead to all this terrible stuff, which is an argument for some sort of government, where it's an argument for a monarchy, or for something, some system of law and order. But that still doesn't help us with this. Because if you look later in Malachim, you'll find that in Malachim, you know, every one of the kings gets a little biography. Right? He was this old when he ruled. This is who his mother's name is, because the king has a lot of wives. He ruled for this long. And then we get some sort of a report card. Right? Typically, the report card is v'lo halach b'darchei David aviv, if he's from Yehuda, or is halach b'derech Yeravam ben Nevat, or he was worse than Yeravam ben Nevat. Almost all the kings get Fs from a religious report card. Other things, they get military, they might get a C+, they might get a B, sometimes they get an A for domestic policy, right? But almost all of them get religious Fs. Right? And what's the religious F? What's the phrasing? So please take a look at two of the uptakes. What?
The religious
F. No, the religious F. Right, failed it from God. Right. So when describing Asa, there's just one quick example. The whole thing would have taken 20 pages of Malachim. But when describing Asa, who comes after Aviyam and who is a good king, it describes him in relationship to David. Asher Asa David etayashar be'enei Adonai. Well, how's David described? Somebody who does that which is right in Hashem's eyes. And Asa himself at the bottom of the page. Vayas Asa hayashar b'nei Adonai. By the way, this is consistently the description. Asa hayashar b'nei Hashem, or more typically, lo Asa hayashar b'nei Hashem. In other words, la'asot hayashar b'nei Hashem is related specifically to leadership. How does that connect with our parasha? The notion is that there is a single leader who enforces a law code and keeps the nation in a healthy societal environment in which people are able to safely grow, et cetera, the government. When does that fall apart? In Jewish history, when does that fall apart? So we have David, Asa Yashar B'nei Hashem. Now, because David was so good, what did Hashem promise him? A dynasty. Even though Shlomo erred, what did Hashem promise him? I'm going to keep my promise to David, which means you're going to die on the throne. You will not be dethroned, and the kingdom won't split in your day. So that David will have had a dynasty. Okay, what happens after Shlomo dies? They split. Now, what's the biggest thing about the split? Yeravam is crowned by the leaders of a tax rebellion in the north. Okay. They don't want to pay taxes anymore to Rehavam, and that could have been settled amicably several ways. First, they had Rehavam turn around and said, okay, you're right, I'll lower the taxes. That's not going to happen. Second of all, if Shmaya had not stepped in and kept Rehavam from using force to try to enforce it. Okay, it was Hashem's stopping him. But even once there's a northern group set up with their own taxation, their own government, it still would not have been considered a split country until what happened? What did Yeravam, what was Yeravam's big move that actually finished the job of separating the kingdoms and made it impossible to ever come back together? Set up a mikdash in the north. Two of them, as a matter of fact. One in Dan and one in Beit El. And what was his reasoning? Everybody's going to go to Yerushalayim to bring korbanot. Rehavam is going to convince them to be loyal to him. They're going to come and kill me, and that'll be the end of it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to send up mikdash here. In other words, what we see from Jewish history is that the centrality and unification of worship is key to the unification of the nation. So what is it Moshe Rabbeinu was saying here? Lo tasun kechol asher anachnu osim po yom ish kol yashar beinav, meaning, up until now, we've been sort of on the move. Yes, of course, you're a great generation, everything fine. But there is still no sense of law and order because we're a group on the move. You're going to settle in. When you settle in, it's going to now be time to become permanent and become a healthy society. And one of the critical things I'm telling you about that healthy society is one local, one centralized place of worship. So it's not going to be like the Rishonim say, this week we're bringing Korbanot in Yotvata, and next week in Amon Divlataima, and then next week in Arvot Moav. There's going to be one central place. But more critically, that one central place will also speak to unified action. And what happens in Sefer Shoftim? Sefer Shoftim is like Bamidbar turned inside out and all the way down the tube. And what happens at the very end, the way it's presented, at the end of Shoftim? You have a nation that not only doesn't have centralized worship, it has centralized nothing. And as a result of that, there's murder, there's mayhem, there's towns raping girls. There's terrible, terrible stories happening. Hold on a second. Because we have this lack of central authority. What Moshe is saying at the very get-go, and this is why the Midrash says it's about Shoftim, and this is why Chazal read Ishkol HaShem Inav as being about Bamat Yachid. It's not just so much that you put a banma in your backyard and it's such an achenvei. It's what you're doing essentially is saying there's no more central place. And the central place of worship is tied into the central place of law, because of course, what is the place of law? What does Yeshayahu tell us? Ki Mitzion? That's where the law is going to come out from. So what Moshe Rabbeinu is giving us here in this very small line, Yishayah Shabbeinav, is kind of a hint to, there's going to, if you do not have a centralized place of worship, you're ultimately going to end up with anarchy. And that's why the Midrash ties this statement of Hayom in with the period of the Shoftim, where that really does play out.